Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Did you guys have a nice lunch?
Yeah.
Are we ready for Vegas?
Yes.
We're going to IPW. Everybody. My name is Luisa Mendoza. I'm founder and CEO of Global Tourism Sports and Entertainment. And today I have the great honor and pleasure of introducing someone very dear to me, someone who I see as a mentor, a friend, Julie Heiser. Has anyone ever sat through her presentation?
Yeah.
Everybody, so you all never. So I just have to say, the first time I ever sat in Julie's presentation, when I went in and, you know, it was going to be like the forecast of international numbers to the U.S., I was like, oh man, these are going to be numbers. Let me make sure I get a coffee. And then I just think she's the most talented person, because to be able to deliver numbers in the way that she does, I think only you can do that, Julie. So with no further ado, I'd love to introduce you to Julie. Take it away.
There's some real diehards in the room, because Steve sat through the same thing yesterday. Like, okay, you're really asking for trouble here. And I get the first slot after lunch, people trying to slough off dessert, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, thank you for letting me share part of your afternoon with you. I really appreciate it. I'm going to tell you the same thing that I tell everybody before I really get into anything. Louise is right. This is a dense presentation. There's a lot of numbers. I don't expect you to be able to track all of it, but if you're interested in having a PowerPoint deck and my talking points, I'm happy to give them to you. If you give me your business card afterwards, I'll shoot them to you this afternoon when I get back to my room and marry the two up. So don't feel like you have to take copious notes or any notes at all. And if you want a siesta, I won't feel bad. Just, you know, give me your card afterwards and you can pretend you heard the whole thing. So. The National Travel and Tourism Office at the U.S. Department of Commerce is really the primary point that the government has for travel and tourism. Why did Commerce get it? Commerce got it because Commerce's job is to promote exports, and international inbound travel to the U.S. is that export. So travel and tourism fits neatly into the Commerce bucket only as it relates to international inbound. We do track outbound because our survey of international air travelers asked departing passengers at airports. So you may be a US citizen departing for your vacation, or you may be an international citizen departing for home after you've been to the US for holidays or business. So we do track outbound, but it's not our primary function. So probably for you guys, besides the numbers that we have that should help inform you about your marketing plans, your promotion activities, et cetera. Probably our second biggest responsibility as far as this audience is concerned is that we do serve as the principal liaison to Brand USA. There really are two sets of us at Commerce who have to do with international exporting, or with exporting, that's a, what do you call that? It's a double whatever. It's redundant, there we go. In addition to our office, and our office really only deals with primarily, apart from Brand USA, we primarily deal with all the data. We are the official source of data, and we deal with tourism policy issues. So if there's something happening on a policy side, particularly that's creating a barrier for travel, a barrier for entry, we get involved at that level. But on the day-to-day exporting side, we have two sets of offices that you guys should know really well. The first one is the U.S. Domestic Commercial Service Field Office. There's about 100 of them around the country. They call them U.S. Export Assistance Centers. Primary thing in that title for you is assistance. If you are thinking about getting into a market and you don't have experience in the market, or you're in a market and you want to expand your presence in a market, the U.S. Export Assistance Center is there in your community, or very close to you probably, to help you do that. And a lot of people don't know that the U.S. Export Assistance Centers even exist, which is a real shame, because that's their job, is to help you export. That's what Commerce does, is we export, or we help export, we don't export anything. And those folks at the domestic offices have contact points in 175 offices around the globe. So if, for instance, you are in Michigan, your Export Assistance Center would be in Detroit, but the Detroit USIAC would be able to connect you and would help you connect to the Commercial Service Office in, God bless you, Brazil or Canada or Mexico or wherever it was that you wanted to take your product. God bless you. The nice thing about travel and tourism product is it all has to stay here, right? So the Export Assistance Center folks, both in the field in the U.S. and in the foreign offices, are really just connectors. They'll help connect you to tour operators in an international arena. They'll help connect you to media in an international arena. They'll help you if you wanted to go, if you wanted to do a sales mission to Sao Paulo. The U.S. Commercial Service Office in Sao Paulo would connect you to the people that you would want to have at, say, a reception, or that you would want to meet with one-on-one at desk side kinds of meetings. So they're a real great resource for you, and you can find them obviously at those email addresses or web addresses. And if you're interested in that, like I said, it's obviously in the PowerPoint presentation that I'll send you, but your quickest link to them is export.gov.
Julie?
Yeah.
Something that people should know, there's a policymaking body, sometimes more than one per state, but at least usually one per state, called the District Export Council.
Right.
And people can be appointed by the Secretary of Commerce. And usually tourism is way underrepresented on that policymaking group.
Absolutely right.
So that they should try to get appointed.
An opportunity for sure if you're interested in volunteering. Uh-huh.
In these offices, is there a dedicated tour and travel person?
In most of the domestic offices, well, the short answer is yes,
okay.
But there's a comma, however,
yep.
Because many of the offices are really small staffs. So in some offices, there might be one person who's the commercial service office for the whole whatever. In other offices, it's divided up by a portfolio. If you go onto the website for at export.gov and you click on find offices, if let's use Detroit. If you clicked on Detroit and then you clicked on the contact us button, in most cases, if there's three or four people listed under the contact us, there'll be a description of what their portfolios include. And that's not always the case, and if there's only one person, you know they're included. You're included in their portfolio because they're it.
Because travel and tourism is not necessarily a tangible thing.
Correct.
Is it usually at the bottom of the categorization of knowledge?
No. And there are some folks in commercial service offices, like for instance in Germany, the gal who has the travel and tourism portfolio, it's one of I think two industries that she's responsible for.
Oh, great. Okay.
In other markets, it might be one of six or seven individual portfolios. It totally depends.
Okay.
The gal who's the U.S. Export Assistance Center person in New York City has travel and tourism, fashion, and I think telecom or something. Okay. So it's kind of an odd mishmash. A while back, there used to be multiple commercial service folks, not in the U.S. but abroad, whose sole portfolio was travel and tourism, and they've eliminated all of those as people have retired and they've just downsizing and staffing and yada yada. But it'll tell you that who it is if the offices are big enough and they've actually split their portfolios out. They'll absolutely tell you that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh huh. And if you can't find somebody, just drop me an email and I'll try to help you connect you. Even if it's just to connect you to the domestic person that we know that's on the travel and tourism team, and then they can connect you further if that's what's warranted. As I said, we are the liaison for Brand USA. You guys probably all should have heard Roger yesterday talking about how Brand USA has been reauthorized through 2027 now. They are the national destination marketing organization, but they can't do their work successfully without you. And I think that that's just my important point for Brand USA. They need the private sector partnership to come to the table. They can access up to $100 million in matching funds on an annual basis, but they cannot do that without private sector match one-on-one. So they have to come to the table with $100 million in cash and in kind in order to unlock the $100 million that's available to them. So they're always looking for good partners. They've got pretty robust programs in place at a whole host of financial levels. So if you're a small destination or even a small individual attraction, you can get into a Brand USA program sometimes for as little as $1,000. And they, you know, go up from there, but they have developed good, strong partnership programs. They've got about 900 partners, but they're always looking for more. I need to update my slide because just last night they premiered their next new large format film, which is called Into America's Wild, and it's about adventurers and adventurers and discoverers and scientists and all the kinds of really interesting people that have come out of the United States and how they've built things that are of interest to travelers around the globe. So quickly, I just want to say, reiterate, our office is really responsible for data and for tourism policy, but we also work really hard with the industry. We listen to the industry, try to make sure that we are doing as good a job as we can to work with the industry to maximize the potential of the travel and tourism industry, to maximize job creation, to grow the economy, and I think to promote peace, honestly, because I think that travel tourism is one of those quiet weapons, so to speak, and that's a bad terminology to use, but that we all have, that the government and all of our leadership have in their back pocket in terms of quiet diplomacy. If we travel and we get to know one another, it's a whole lot harder, I think, to be at odds as a people. So just a personal thing about making sure that we're connecting on a personal level when we do our travel work. So let's look at the big impact of travel and tourism. Before I do that, I just want to take half a second to talk about the dinosaur that is our website. I mean that in all sincerity. I came back to the U.S. Department of Commerce in 2003, and the homepage looked exactly like this. It's really frightening. And actually, this isn't the homepage, but this page looked the same, too. There's a ton of information on our website, a ton. If you're digging for what's happening in Brazil, if you're digging for what's happening in the leisure market, if you're digging for who's traveling from overseas to Native American communities around the country, there's a piece of that information on our website. We're working at the moment to try to get it begrudgingly into the 19th century. I'm finally starting to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Check back at the website over the course of the next, hopefully, year, and it'll at least look a little different and be a little more user-friendly than it is now. If you're on there and you can't find what you're looking for, give me a buzz, drop me an email. If I can't find it, which, oh yeah, happens regularly, I can point you to the guys in the shop who can absolutely point you right to what it is that you're looking for. Travel tourism, no surprise to you guys, is a $256 billion industry internationally. And while there are about 9 million people who hold their jobs responsible for travel and tourism, of those, 1.3 million are completely dependent on the international inbound traveler for their job. So it's an important, international inbound travel is important on a whole host of levels for us. Global, bigger picture, overall travel and tourism industry, almost a $2 trillion business, and represents almost 3% of our total overseas overall GDP. Which is huge. We're bigger than insurance services. We're bigger than financial services. We're bigger than car parts and auto pieces. So I think that coming together like this gives you an opportunity to work with one another, but it also gives you an opportunity to hear people like Roger and like Elliot Ferguson at the national level, and to give you an opportunity to talk to those people, because we do have an important role to play in the economy. We do have an important voice to play in the economy and policy for the administration, but they have to hear it. And so if you have an opportunity to chew on the ear of folks at the national level. These are the numbers particularly that our congressional people are looking at and paying attention to. Obviously, everybody from in Congress works for a district that probably has a pretty robust travel and tourism industry at home and may or may not know. So that's an important function as well. Before we see where we're headed, let's revisit where we've been a little bit. This is our volume for 2018 for our top 21 markets. Countries are sorted in order of their volume, so you can see Canada and Mexico up there at the top. Green in the on the right there shows an increase for 2018 over 17. Red means a decline. The black numbers, if you can see them, show that there was a jump in ranking. So, for instance, in 2018, Brazil jumped over Germany, India jumped over Australia, etc., and Ireland bumped up two slots over Sweden and Venezuela. From here, as I said, you can see that Mexico and Canada are still dominating in the marketplace, and you can also see the rankings changes and the fact that performances for 2018, at least, were mixed. Here's your volume performance in 18 versus 17. This is based on percent change, gives you a little bit of a different picture about the strength of the markets. Red's negative, green's positive. And I should have caveated by saying all of these were done before we had the norovirus challenge. So that obviously may change. It may not change. This may be a short-lived, hopefully, a short-lived problem with China, and the numbers for 20 won't be as bad as maybe they could have been or might have been. But Brazil, Colombia, and Ireland had the highest growth rates in 18, and we expected good growth rates from those markets, but they were even stronger than we had thought they would be. China and South Korea had the largest rates of decline, which even before the norovirus had not been expected from either of those markets. So that was percent change. Here's volume change. Gives you another look at the same picture. Enables us to be able to more clearly see who contributed to overall volume growth and which ones were drags on that growth. Canada, Mexico's large volume base, coupled with a similar modest growth, easily it produced the largest and second largest growth rates for us, respectively. For all other of our top origin markets, volume changes were small individually, but often represented reversals in performance versus the previous year. And actually, even the smaller markets collectively added up to 500,000 additional visitors for 2018 versus 2017. And finally, one last look at volume. Here's where we stood for 2019 year to date over 2018. Our 2019 figures will be out probably within the next couple of weeks. The guys are working on inputting that data now to the big picture stuff that they do on the database, and they'll get that out pretty quickly. Total international travel was down 1.3% at that point, reflecting a combination of a 1.1 increase in total overseas visitors, but coupled with a 3.9% decrease for Canada, as well as a 3.1% decrease for Mexico. Year-to-date are obviously, again, mixed across the top 21 countries, including those big declines for Canada and Mexico, but followed by stronger-than-expected gains from the UK and from Japan. Here you see spending, top rankings for our same top 21 markets for 18. These reflect the data revision that was released in October of 2019 and includes revisions all the way back to 2009. Travel exports include spending in the U.S. as well as spending on U.S. company carriers to travel to the U.S. and the same as with volume is based on our residency. Travel exports includes all spending by all travelers. As you can see there at the top, China became the top growth market a few years ago, but it also included the Bureau of Economic Analysis's revision of what they count as a travel export, and which now includes education exports from the services exports overhaul that they did in 2014. So they revised all that data in 2014, and then we went back all the way to 1999 to make the same revisions. So when you see our charts now, timeline charts now, it's all comparing apples and apples. So they went back and put education and seasonal migrant worker and medical travel spending in the numbers that you see all the way back to 1999, so you can always be looking at the same at data that matches. 43% of China's travel exports are education travel exports and include the impact of about 370,000 university students who are here in the U.S., along with countless numbers of students at younger in the younger lower grades. Similarly, about 38% of Mexico travel exports include seasonal and migrant workers. So that's a key thing to realize when you're looking at spending numbers. Here's a percent change in spending. Countries with increases from 17 to 18, fortunately, still outnumber those with decreases, about 13 to 8. Performances generally follow volume visitor changes in direction and magnitude, but not perfectly because of per-person spending and other factors. Here's the actual change in spending from 2017 to 2018. India, Canada, Brazil, the UK, and Mexico increases accounted for the bulk of the overall plus $4.6 billion that we saw in that year. Unlike volume, travel export data are not available at a monthly level at the country level. BEA releases their overall estimates in March of any one year for the previous year. They revise in June, and then they revise again in October. So these data are October, including their most recent revision in October. Put those together and you see how spending and volume pretty much look like they trend the same. The values on the graph are different, so they really don't. But this was the SARS epidemic here and then the 2009 recession here. So you can see, you know, that when big things happen, it makes a big difference to travel, tourism, visitation, and spending. Here's a comparison of our top 10 volume markets, our origin markets. On the left is arrivals, on the right is spending. Country rankings obviously differ depending on those two things. On the left-hand side, you can see that France makes the chart for visitation, but not for spend, and Australia makes a chart for spend and not visitation. So pretty much the same folks, a little bit of different order, except for those two countries, which make it on one and not the other. Here's a different look. Shows you that the U.S. is by far the largest country in terms of receipts, but it also shows you that we have slipped to third spot in terms of visitation against our primary competitors. One of the reasons that this 214 shows as 214 and not as 256 is because the UNWTO, who generates this chart, does not include passenger fares paid to airlines, because in many countries the airline is owned by the government, and so they don't report the numbers themselves, or they're not necessarily viable. So if you added, or if you put the amount of money that's spent on passenger fares on U.S. carriers, they would actually bump Macau off of the list and be the 10th largest country just on their own. So obviously airfare spending is an important part of our overall numbers, but not reflected in the UNWTO chart. Also keep in mind that, and I think this is interesting, I don't know that there's a way to fix it, but for instance, on the visitation side, all countries don't count their visitors the same way. So for instance, India, the U.S. counts students as visitors. India does not. India counts foreign nationals residing abroad who come home to visit as visitors. The U.S. does not. So you're not always looking at apples and apples when you're looking at the visitation numbers, because each country has the opportunity, I guess, to count visitors however they want to count them. And so we're not always looking at the same in terms of how they rank up. But it's still an interesting trend interesting way to look at what the numbers look like overall and how we stack up overall. Okay, trends we watch, and I'm gonna show these to you guys because these are the trends. Many of the trends that the economists and the researchers in our office use when they're developing the forecast, which we're getting to. So from the UNWTO in Madrid, global inbound travel volume continues to grow more or less on their schedule of declining growth through the year 2030, which is their out year for their forecast. This is based on each country reporting its inbound volume to UNWTO, so there's always, you know, margin of error there. 2016 globally was up 3.6%, 17 was up 7.0%, and 2018 was up 5.6%. And as the slide adds, it's up moderate to strong for all of our top markets except China, South Korea, Brazil, and Switzerland. Outbound volumes by country, arrivals were up, as it shows here, 0.07% in 17 for the US and up 3.5% in 2018. Unfortunately, 2019 was very uneven, and we believe that we will probably end up about 1% down overall. Airlines remain optimistic about overall seat capacity to the US to start the new decade, but not overly so. And again, their outlook is mixed and uneven across our top markets. Strong growth in US outbound, shifting of direct flights for indirect and vice versa, transit through the US to Canada and key hubs in key ports of departure such as Heathrow, Frankfurt, and Toronto make this data source a little bit less useful for the guys in the office when they're doing the forecast, but it's still something that they keep a close eye on. Department of Homeland Security's Advanced Passenger Information System is a citizenship-based census count of everybody who comes to the U.S. Via air, regardless of their residence or purpose of trip. Non-U.S. citizen counts showed consistently solid growth up through 2018, but was up just 1% for 2019. We also look at the electronic system for travel authorization. They were interestingly fairly flat for the year, up just 1.8% in 18 and only up 0.6% through June. They did have a nice strong December at plus 8, and then I just got email from Mark Brown in our office last night late, and he said that January was also up like 11%. I'd have to check that number on my phone. Maybe a good indication for a start to the new year. Brand USA, as I mentioned earlier, has that matching fund capacity. They get that matching fund from the Travel Promotion Fund, which is funded by $10 of the ESTA fee. Inadvertently, Congress broke the link in December of 18 when they were putting the budget together. And so when U.S. Travel and others in the private sector, yourselves included, I hope, were talking to Congress about reauthorizing them in December of this past year, they had to go to Congress with a way to provide funding, new funding, because that link had been inadvertently broken. So the $10 that was originally slated for Brand USA's matching fund through the ESTA collection is no longer available to Brand USA. So U.S. Travel and others went to Congress and said, okay, if you'll increase the ESTA fee, then the money from the increase can go to fund Brand USA. So that's what they've done. So the ESTA fee will now go from $14 per person every 2 years or when your passport expires, whichever's first, to $21. And that $7 will go now into the matching fund that's available for Brand USA to pull from. They look at International Monetary Fund data, because that's another way that somebody else accounts for the strength of the travel and tourism industry. They look at U.S. visa issuance. For 2018, fiscal year 2018, visa issuance was down 9% and was down now overall 21% since its peak in 2015. It is a leading indicator of future travel, but not great because so many countries now have the 10-year visa. So if you get a visa in 2020, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to come to the U.S. in 2020. It might, but it doesn't necessarily so. So you have to be careful about using that as a real strong indicator, but it still is nonetheless an indicator. So before we get to the... Oh, I forgot to pass those out. Sorry. Before we get to that, here is the chart I'm going to be looking at because there's no way you're going to be able to see that. And then the other piece of paper I'm giving you is our fast facts. which is really just a quick look at those blue slides that I showed early on. It tells you about the overall picture of the U.S. and also gives you our top country markets for in visitation as well as in spending. So if you've got somebody who's looking for a quick data hit, just those two pieces. Okay, so the brilliant, and I really do mean that, the brilliant economists at the office put this forecast together. It used to be something that we farmed out, and we don't do that anymore because we don't have the funding to do it. So we've brought it in-house, and fortunately over the last probably 6 or 8 years, the guys have been really pretty good on balance in some markets at a good level, off on some other markets, but overall about in the middle, which is really where you want them to fall. Lots of information on this slide. So if you look at it, on the left, you see change metrics for the top 21 markets. Why do we keep talking about the top 21 markets? A couple of reasons. First off, in some instances, the 20th and 21st markets bounce back and forth between each other, or you know, one year over the other. But we also look at these top 21 markets because they account for about 87% of the total spend for the U.S. So that's the bulk of the business that comes to the U.S. comes from these 21 markets. And they're on this chart for you in rank order from 2018. The new forecast is obviously for 2019 through 2024. 19 because when we did this back, when the guys did this back in October or September, we didn't have obviously year-end figures yet for 19, so the forecast starts there. And as I mentioned, IMF forecasts out to 2024, and so that's also the same year that we use. Louisa, did everybody else get?
Yep.
Okay.
I was putting it off.
Okay. Useful change metrics on the right-hand side of this chart shows you what the actual volume change we predict will be in 2024 versus 2018 and the corresponding overall change rate. You can see that there are three countries that the team believes will not see growth over the forecast period. So 2019 was expected to end down 1% by the time we have the full year of data. We think we're going to be pretty spot on about that, and we'll know that more about that by the end of the month. The growth rates for 20 to 24 are actually positive, will be somewhere between 2% and 3%, which is just about in the same growth range that Roger estimated yesterday, and his team also does a forecast. So I thought it was interesting to hear that we're kind of in the same neck of the woods as far as what we think is going to happen in the marketplace. All countries are expected to continue to grow or resume to a growth mode for each year of the forecast, except for Argentina, Sweden, and Venezuela. Fourth, growth rates are led by India at plus 37%. France at plus 25, Taiwan at plus 23, and Colombia at the same, plus 23. And as I said, this was before the current coronavirus challenge, but we've got China, Brazil, and Switzerland expected to grow at a rate of about 18% for the same period. And five countries are expected to account for 58% of that 87% of total growth volume between 18 and 24, which are, as you see, Canada, Mexico, the UK, China, and India. So here's our actual volume from 2000 to 2018 in blue. Orange starts 2019, and by the end of this month, we think we'll just change the first orange bar to blue, because we really expect it to be flat, down 1%. So that won't look vastly different. The actual won't look vastly different than what we had predicted here before. So, changing gears a little bit, this slide, this is the third year that we've been able to talk to you a little bit about hotel motel room nights as it relates to international inbound travel. And it's important because many of our DMOs around the country are funded by those hotel motel taxes. We get to this number, these estimates, by using several of the data points of our survey of international air travelers, which include the total volume of one plus night visitors to the U.S., the proportion of visitors who used a hotel or motel, their mean average length of stay, and their average party size. And we presume that one room, it's one room per travel party. Most important for this audience today, I think, is that in 2018, 21% of all accommodations usage in U.S. hotels and motels was by international travelers. So you guys present a big, almost a quarter of the volume of room nights. Here's another trend we debuted at the Portland Summit a couple years back. This is on package travel. Shows you the proportion of visitors who used a package who used a package on their U.S. trip. Countries are listed in descending order of volume to the U.S. The downward slide in package incidence for overseas countries that started in 2015 continued into 2018, but it doesn't mean that it was down for everybody. You know, there's always that some bounce up, some bounce down in any given year. But it was about an even mix of increases and decreases for all of the top overall markets. Once again, package demand in 2018 was actually up slightly, but Mark tells me it was up because of an increase in total overseas visitors, actually more, he says, more than offset the small decline in package demand incidents. So this is exactly the opposite of what we were able to tell you last year about this. So if you gather all that stuff together, here's a slide you can probably actually see, which shows you what the package incidence rate of use is for these top 20 plus markets. Japan's still very dependent on package travel, and then descending, as you can see, down to Singapore in the bottom there. Mark built this particular slide using 3 years of data because it just gives you a better feel for how the markets bounce out, how they vie for, you know, slots. It also takes out anomaly years and other kind of odd things that might have happened in a one-off. So he feels much more comfortable in showing this kind of data in a three-year spread. So the data on package travelers, as I mentioned, comes from the Survey of International Air Travelers. It asks for all different kinds of information. These are, as I said way earlier, these are intercept studies at airports primarily. We do still have some airlines that will work with us and distribute surveys on board, but post 9/11 that has really fallen, the number of airlines that will let us do on board surveying. So we've moved to intercept surveys at airports, and but it's still the same great information. So if you're looking for demographics and psychographics and where people went and how much they spent and how far in advance they planned their trip, et cetera, that's all the kind of data that we get out of the Survey of International Air Travel. All of that's posted to our travel.trade.gov website, and it's free. The thing that we've changed most specifically, which I think is great for people in the marketplace who like numbers and who like to do that kind of research and mess around with, you know, what if this and what if that. The information for the profiles is now posted in Excel format. So instead of having a 2016 profile and a 2017 profile and a 2018 profile, now we just have a package profile, and every year we will add a column of data for that previous year. So these now go all the way back to 97, and while I'm not real good at math, I can tell you that that's at least two decades worth of material that you can track and utilize so that you can see what your trend changes have been for any particular market. As it's 97, we expect to get, expect to get all of our new data from 2019 up probably late spring. 2018, the sample size was about 5,600 for package travelers. We survey about 90,000 people overall for the survey in any given year. And you can get custom reports done by our office. We're happy to do that. So for instance, if you wanted to look at winter package travelers versus summer package travelers, and are those different for your destination? You can do that. It costs a couple thousand dollars to get a custom run, and you decide. Pardon me. You decide what the banners will be, so you really are in control. So, if you wanted to know how you were doing in package travel from Japan, Australia, UK, Brazil, Canada, you could specifically get a survey, a custom run that would tell you that. Come on. So, I'm just going to pull all these up. Mark used Japan as the example. So, the package travel program says that Japan was one half of package travels 20 years ago, but it's only one third today. China was not even on the radar. It's now 9%. Planning has changed. The use of guides has changed. That information is captured in the report. It tells you, as I said, who's traveling, what's the use of hotels and motels, first or repeat visitors, etc. All of this stuff really gives you great opportunity to look at what markets you're interested in and what kind of information you can get about those markets from the report. The thing that's important to me, the package travel report is one of about 30 profile reports that are on the website. So we've got overall overseas travel. We've got regions are reported. We've got Central America, Asia, South America, Europe. We've got individual market reports. So you can look at a report specifically on Brazil or China or Argentina or UK or France or whatever. And we also have segment reports. So you can look at lodging. You can look at leisure. You can look at business. You can look at, as I said earlier, American Indian travel or international travel in American Indian destinations. So lots and lots of really good information available to you in report form on our ancient website. So even though it's ancient, you still can get good stuff out of it. Quickly, global travel continues to be a global growth industry. Growth in 2019 we expect will be lower, but lower from higher than originally forecasted levels, so not as bad as we had thought. About 1% down, as I said earlier. U.S. volume increased in 2018 to a new record, but it's preliminarily down 1% in 2019. And interestingly, performances across the countries were very uneven. So it's not like you could look at the data and say, oh, all of Asia was down, because that wasn't true, or all of South America was up, because that wasn't true. Really, we really saw multiple country fluctuations without any real clear patterns. It's just an interesting observation. The forecast expected a decline for 2019. That happened. But we still expect record volumes through 2024. Five countries will account for that volume growth. As we mentioned, you can see those there, Canada, Mexico, UK, we hope still China and India. International travelers account for 21% of the lodging demand across the country. Room nights led by, not surprisingly, basically those same countries. But changes are reflected a combination of overall volume, hotel, motel incidents, stay rate, party size, all that stuff. Package travelers are an important part of what's available. But there are, like I said, lots of other really good profiles available on the website. And that's how you find me if you don't want to give me your card and want to have an opportunity to take a look at our website. The one thing that I forgot to mention when I was talking about policy, you guys may or may not know that the Secretary of Commerce has an advisory board that provides him with advice and counsel. It's a private sector board. That board's charter is up this year. We will be rechartering in the summer, and we will be looking for volunteers who are interested in bringing your sector's perspective to the Secretary of Commerce. one of the great things in my mind about the TTAB, Travel and Tourism Advisory Board, is that, let's say, I'm gonna make this up, let's say visa wait times in Brazil suddenly skyrocketed, and instead of being a couple of days, instead of it taking a couple of days to get an interview for a visa, you had to wait now 47 days. That's a potential market barrier for us, right? Because if you can't get a visa, you can't come. So that's an issue that could be brought to the Secretary of Commerce. Now, as I like to say, we don't have a dog in a lot of these fights because we don't have anything to do with visa issuance. But the Secretary, in addition to having the Travel and Tourism Advisory Board on the private sector side, has an organization over on this side called the Tourism Policy Council, and anybody in the cabinet level who has a travel and tourism mission of any kind, i.e. visa issuance, sits on the Tourism Policy Council. So if the private sector says to the Secretary of Commerce, we have a problem, a market barrier problem that needs to be solved, he has the ability then to take that private sector input to the Tourism Policy Council and say to the State Department, you have a problem that you need to fix, because my private sector is going to be affected by your ability to fix this problem. So same thing with biometrics for DHS, or maybe there's an interior problem. It's an opportunity for the private sector to get information into the Secretary of Commerce, give him the opportunity to talk to Tourism Policy Council. Tourism Policy Council has worked on a whole host of issues, including biometrics, based on input from the private sector. And then he has the ability then to come back to the TTAB and say, hey, you brought me problem X, biometrics, visa wait, whatever it is. I took it to my colleagues at the State Department, DHS, Transportation, whoever it was. Here's the answer that we've come up with, so that we think we've eliminated that market barrier. So if you're interested in having an opportunity to feed information and challenges and industry input to the Secretary of Commerce, I would encourage you to look. You can go to the Federal Register notice, and if you sign up and say you're interested in any FRN that comes through that has travel and tourism as a keyword, when the Federal Register notice for the TTAB comes up, you would automatically get a notification that it's time to look for that Federal Register notice. And then it's a self-application process. You send your resume and a letter that says, here's why I'd like to serve, and then they pick. I think the number is up to, I think the law says that the board can be up to 32 private sector people. And we do a very, I think, a very good job of making sure that that's spread across geography so that all areas of the country are included. It's also spread across sectors so that there's not too many people from DMOs or too many people from transportation or attractions or whatever. So we really try to keep a good balance of industry and geography as we're filling out the board. So that is my pitch for the afternoon. Anybody have any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Julie, thank you for that presentation. Colombia, it's one of the countries in Latin America and South America that we see is having growth to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Any reason as to why why you guys feel that Colombia has had such great growth to the U.S.?
I'm not an expert, but I think part of it probably has to do with airline lift. I heard yesterday somewhere that that Lyft is better from many of the South American markets, so I think that's probably part of it. I also think that lots of people live here from South American, Latin American countries. It might be more visiting friends and relatives. It might be more people coming to school here. And I also think, there's generally speaking, I think there is, regardless of current issues, there's always an interest in seeing the U.S. because of our music, because of our movies, because of our television programs. And the more of those that are translated into other markets, other languages, people start to build their bucket list. I think, it's just an emerging destination. But I also think that we probably were not first on Colombians' list. Like, we may have been first on Chinese travelers' list or first on Brazilian travelers' list. But now people have started to travel more, and so they've, I did that one. Oh, now it's time for me to come to the U.S. I think part of the challenge for you guys in this room is really at the repeat traveler level, because we have to keep telling people who have come here that there's reason to come back here. So, like, this is a perfect destination for that. You know, you come to Florida, you've seen Miami, you've seen Orlando, you've seen the Keys, but there's 782 other Florida destinations that have something that you might be interested in. And I think that that's happening all over the place. I think it's one of the reasons that we see an uptick in interest in Native American travel, because people, even as many or as few years ago as maybe 15 or 20, Native Americans were not yet really ready to welcome visitors in many ways, culturally, physically, but now the Native American community has really turned to travel and tourism as an economic driver for them. And so many of the tribes now have put together package programs, experiential programs, even overnights, in Native American homes, so that people get an experience, a real authentic American experience that isn't about casino gaming. When they're really trying to not be viewed as, oh, it's an Indian reservation, therefore there's a casino. There's so much more experiential, so much more rich product available. But there are cultural challenges to overcome. For some tribes you can go to one of their powwows. For other tribes, those are closed events. For some people, for some tribes, they'll let you see their dances, but they'll only do for you the dances that are public. They won't do private dances for the public. So they're still learning themselves, but I think it's just part of that experience, and it's been great for the U.S. because it's given people who are maybe repeat visitors the opportunity to look differently at, say, the same destination. So instead of going to North Carolina to the beach, you might go to North Carolina to the mountains because that's where you can see the Band of Cherokee. So it's incumbent upon you guys in the industry to continue to put new product in front of people.
I noticed that so much of your information mirrors what we're experiencing here in Florida and right here in the St. Pete, Clearwater, Tampa Bay area. The Brexit, 3-4 years ago, we thought that was going to be a major factor in a possible decline of the UK visitor. It seems like it hasn't been at all.
Not yet.
And they're like, you know what, Brexit's always going to be a pain in the ass. Looks like we're still going to go. But what has happened to the German market? Germany used to be a great market for Florida, especially for the west coast of Florida. And we're just seeing it slowly, slowly fade away. And the numbers seem to show a decline. I just can't understand what's the matter with the Germans.
I don't think
they're... I'm a German, so I can say there's a lot of problems with us, but...
I'm German by half. I don't think there's anything wrong with us. I think there's a couple things. I think, first of all, they may be, some of them may be more price sensitive, and the dollar is way stronger than it has been. I think that's a real issue for some markets. I think part of it is that there's just way the hell too much global competition out there now that wasn't there even 4, 5, 6 years ago. I mean, whoever heard of Mauritius until recently? Think about the number of other country product ads we see on a daily basis.
Sure, sure.
Television, print,
Croatia,
online.
Turkey.
Exactly.
Those were not existent 5, 6 years ago.
Correct. So now that, most of the rest of the world has discovered that travel and tourism is a really good economic driver, there's just a lot more competition out there. And I think that, in combination with price sensitivity, now, price sensitivity is only going to hit a certain percentage of the marketplace, right? So, the guys in Germany who have the money to go wherever they want, that's not going to, price sensitivity is not an issue for them, but now they've got Croatia, Turkey, Mauritius, the Seychelles, whoever, available to them. I think it's, and I think there's always, and this is a terrible phrase and I don't mean it this way, I think there are always winners and losers. You know, it's all cyclical. The UK is up, then the UK is down. The UK is up, then the UK is down. Same thing with Germany, up, down, up, down. Same thing with Japan, up, down, up, down. Some of them, like Japan, has never recovered from its high. I think their biggest year to the US was like in 2009 or 2010. No, that's not right. Nine was early 2000s. They just haven't bounced back. And you know, I think it's aging population in some countries. It's focus on different aspects of travel. So I don't think that you can point to one particular thing. It'll be interesting to hear what Elizabeth Walsh, our commercial services person, would say to that. So I'll ask her that question and see what her take on it is, because she's boots on the ground in the market. Be happy to share that with you if I can get anything good out of her. Be happy to let you know.
Any other questions?
Anything else? All right, guys, go get some fresh air.
Don't forget your surveys, please.